When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Guys, listen to this. Do you know anything about dual sidewall design, whisper grooves, earth diggers, or three-peak mountain certification? The Discover Rugged Trek Tire from Cooper has all of that and more. The unique dual sidewall design looks great and gives drivers the options for wear. Whisper groove technology blocks air from whistling through the tire, keeping that road noise where it belongs, outside. And if you find yourself out mudding with your friends, the Earth Diggers are large scoops and blocks on the side of the tire that act like cogs in a gear to help you dig in the loose dirt, sand, and mud, giving you traction on the trail. All of this has earned the Rugged Trek a three-peak certification, confidence that it has the goods to back up the looks. All Cooper tires are backed by a limited warranty, a 45-day test drive warranty, and select products are backed by tread wear mileage warranty, helping to give you confidence on the road. For complete product and warranty details, please visit www.coopertires.com or www.coopertires.ca. And remember, go with the Coopers.
Friends, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Crash Course Podcast. This is DJ, joined very specially. This is a podcast debut by a guy who we work with just about every day, Matt Golden. If you don't know that name, you've probably seen him credited in many of our videos since the beginning of time when we started doing videos. Matt, how are you? Where are you coming from today? And how are you again?
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Yeah, out from behind the editing machine, in front of the microphone, ready to talk about something really special in Erin Hills. Coming to you from just outside of Athens, Georgia. And I mean, I'll disclose it. It's my house. It's my home office. So
perfect. Well, like I said, I'm sure people have probably seen your name if they're uber familiar with No Laying Up, but might not know a ton about you. Give the people a little bit of background. We're going to do the abbreviated Erin Hills story. What's the abbreviated Matt Golden story here?
Oh my gosh. I wish my story was any bit as interesting as the Erin Hills story.
No murders in the backstory. Deeds changing hands.
Wildly obsessive, you know, $20 million loss. No, it's exactly. Really, you know, from here in Atlanta, went to school in Auburn, go Tigers, and kind of figure out a way to mix golf with being creative and being technical and editing, but also telling stories. So yeah, man, pumped to kind of do what I love every day. You know, don't take that for granted.
I love it. Matt and I met randomly via email. I think we get a sizable amount of emails from people that are like, Hey, you know, I'd love to help. I'd love to be involved. Just let me know. And Matt had the key, he could not have said a better thing at a better time, which was my specialty is just taking a big pile of unorganized footage and trying to spin it into a story. I was like, oh my God, that is exactly what we need right now because we have no fucking idea what we're doing. So Matt started helping us. I believe the first things were Tour of Sauce Season 1 in Australia, and we have been very lucky to work with him ever since. And we're getting ready to work on Tour Sauce Season 7 here shortly. So Matt, let's get into it. The reason that you are here today, this was a great idea by Cody. We were doing our weekly video meeting and you mentioned offhand that you had a trip coming up to Erin Hills. Matt, we should mention, a good player in his own right. And Cody was kind of like, hey, DJ, you know, you're the one that's always raving about Erin Hills, right? I was like, yes, can't say enough good stuff about Erin Hills. He's like, all right, when Matt gets back, you guys definitely need to do a Crash Course podcast about it because no one else has played it. No one else knows what you're talking about. Matt, now you're officially, we've talked a little bit about it, but it sounds like you've kind of seen the light on this place that most people know for a relatively boring U.S. Open. But talk to me about the context of why you were there and what your initial impression was of Erin Hills.
Yeah, honestly, the context, I you know, it was like a week before we went and I had no idea I was going to go visit Wisconsin the next week. my buddy was like, hey, I'm going to check this place out. And I'm like, cool, I've got some sky miles to kill and I will be there.
Perfect.
So I was like, what time's our tea time? In extremely quick trip, flew up on a Wednesday, flew back on a Thursday afternoon. But overall impressions, like, I mean, we'll get into it, but the overall scale of the place is, it just makes you feel small in a really cool way.
It can't be overstated how big it is.
Yeah.
It feels like it is the entire state of Wisconsin while you're out there.
And then they tell you, you know, like the golf course is a third of the property they have. Yes, and yeah, your exactly. mind is blown. Overall, it's probably the most land movement I've seen on a course in the States. Mm-hmm. I haven't been to Ireland or Scotland or anything yet, but just some general themes. Like the land movement was something I look back on today. It's like, that's more like hiking on a couple of those holes than...
Not an easy walk.
Yeah, for sure. It's a blast.
A couple of kind of demographic details, I guess we'll call them. Just as far as location, we're talking about 45 minutes or so northwest of Milwaukee. Fairly accessible place for how remote it actually feels when you get out there.
It's a lovely drive too. That's
exactly what I was going to say. One of the most beautiful drives, like just completely idyllic, right? And when we were there, it sounds like you got this as well, but I went up there with my dad just for background, and it was, I think, about 38 degrees when we teed off and about 25 mile an hour winds sustained. Not a lot of trees out there to block what's going on. It's pretty much you versus the elements. So even with that, just a completely idyllic drive. You're winding through small towns. There's lakes and ponds and rivers everywhere. Beautiful trees. I mean, it's just like I don't usually point that out as like one of my big takeaways, but just an absolutely gorgeous drive.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I haven't spent any time in Milwaukee or anything. That part of the country was really cool to see.
I think the other thing we got to dive into is probably the history of the place. And I want to get in front of this first and say, I have no delusions of trying to tell the entire history of Erin Hills. I know I mentioned this in the video version that we did, which Matt edited, I believe. But the video version of the crash course we did on Erin Hills, there's an excellent, I believe, 7-part series by Gary D'Amato of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, it's a newspaper story, but it's essentially a book. It's like 60,000 words. It took me forever to actually read through this thing the first time. Matt, did you read this? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I did, yeah. And I sent it to my buddy who was going up with me. And the amount of context first of all, yes. You know, it takes like an hour and a half to read. It's it's not a quick read. Yeah. The amount of context it shed on the course and on the experience and the people there, like it made it so much more than just visiting a high-end course where you go pay your fee and go play and have a cool caddy or whatever. It's like, okay, there's a story and a history, and you can see why this land was so interesting to so many people. And
100%.
Yeah.
And so this was a highest recommendation of reading if you've been to Erin Hills or if you haven't been to Erin Hills or if you're thinking about going or if you're not thinking about going. I mean, it's a geology lesson. It's a sociology lesson. It's everything, man. It's really, really well done. All the props in the world to Gary D'Amato for doing that. But the incredibly high level couple bullet point background on Erin Hills. Essentially, it all revolves around a guy named Bob Lang. And Matt, it's probably been more recent that you've read this story than I have, so please feel free to correct me or heat check me on any of this stuff. But as I remember it, Bob became obsessed with the idea of building a golf course to host a U.S. Open after, I believe, attending the 2000 U.S. Open at Pebble Beach is, I think, where it all started. And which is, you know, if you can't really get bitten by the golf bug at the 2000 U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. I don't really know what to tell you. But after that, Bob, who, you know, was from this area of the country, gets totally obsessed with this idea of I'm going to build a golf course. I'm going to host a U.S. Open, which if you know anything about the golf industry, U.S. Open venues, politics, how all these things happen, like that's among, I would say, the more laughable sentences you could possibly say. It's just like, yeah, no, I know I'm an outsider, but I'm just going to infiltrate the bluest of blue bloods. I'm going to build a new course, and they're going to host their most prestigious championship at it. So the fact, the story doesn't really end well for Bob, but the fact that that was the goal and that he, I mean, for all intents and purposes, he literally did it is unbelievable. Well, like, before, that can't be overshadowed.
Yeah, yeah. And before, you know, Chambers, was this one of the first time or the one of the first ever
right.
a modern course has been built for this purpose, and it actually totally. Happened.
It worked. I know. It's wild. It's absolutely insane. So Bob finds some funding for this course with another business partner. He brings in all the big name architects. He passes on all of them. I think I remember there wasn't there a Doak routing for it? I think Doak was attached to it at first. And
he says there's a lot of courses, but he sketched 1,000 holes on this property. Did you hear that?
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Would love to see that as well.
And this is the whole thing about Erin Hills is, I mean, it looks like they have room for about 15 more golf courses. Yeah. So I'm sure there's a couple of those 1,000 that could probably be recycled for another course, but that's neither here nor there. Instead, they go with the relatively unknown trio at the time of Michael Hursden, Dana Fry, and Ron Witten. Things kind of stall out a little bit. It sounds like, you know, there were no real shovels in the ground for quite a while, but finally they get, you know, they get the funding right, they get the timing right, and the course starts moving. Bob somehow meets, I believe this was at the 2014 US Open, somehow meets the right people at the USGA, convinces them to come take a look. They love the land. They're obsessed with the vision. They agree to give him the 2011 US Amateur, which this is always a cool thing. I love when the USGA does that, is kind of using the AM as a test case for, you know, new courses. I know Chambers Bay and Erin Hills are kind of the only great examples of that, but I love when they do that. That's such a cool little wrinkle. So as you know, again, we're skipping through a massive amount of history here. There's a murder involved with a business partner. It's just there's a lot that goes into the story. Again, please go read the full thing. But Bob kind of, you know, goes off the deep end, I guess we'll say, trying to tweak the golf course, trying to put more of his own money into it, trying to just make it as good as it possibly can be, and kind of becomes, by all reports, a bit of an obsessive, to the point where he's out there with shovels moving bunkers and just really doing the kind of stuff that architects are really not looking for from an owner. Eventually he runs out of time, he runs out of money. It just, you know, he kind of has chased this thing into the deepest depths of his obsession. And is forced to sells the golf course to a guy named Andy Ziegler, who the story, you know, and all accounts kind of paint as basically the fixer here. I mean, I think I forget a little bit what his actual background was, but, you know, had a ton of means to actually make the course exactly what it needed to be. They needed to kind of rapid fire, do a bunch of stuff before the 2011 USAM just to get the course playable, which he does. He brings in the right people, gets everything knocked out. 2011 USAM goes off without a hitch for the most part. And eventually they, you know, they're able to make good on their offer to host a 2017 US Open. And then unfortunately the wind doesn't blow and everybody thinks it's a boring course and it creates kind of an identity crisis for the USGA. And it's, you know, debatable whether they'll ever have another major championship. So it's a fascinating story, made even more fascinating by what happened in 2017, I think. And yeah, anything to add there?
Yeah, you know, a couple things about Bob Lang. So they also in 08 hosted the Women's Pub Links.
Right.
And I think they were really pushing to have a playable golf course at that point. And you kind of, the fairways were, I think they were talking about their ground under repairs. Like they ran out of spray paint cans with all the right. ground under repairs they were trying to put all over the place. And the course like evolved so massively from 19 holes to a par 75 to all these different routings that they actually went out and built. But yeah, he's out there with shovels, you know, kind of doing his own thing after he's fired everybody else. But yeah, like Mike Davis came back before, I guess it was before the AM in 2011, you know, hey, I think you should make these couple changes, you know, these couple tweaks maybe for infrastructure or these service roads or whatever. You know, they estimated it was like a couple $100,000 job, and he goes out and takes a $2.6 million loan to go above and beyond, truly. So, you know, just, yeah, kind of hearing how he kept entangling himself with massive amounts of debt was pretty jarring. But
again, the fact that any of this even happened in the first place is outrageously unlikely and impressive. And it's just I don't know, man. There's some drama in the story. So again, for the fifth time, go read the background. Yeah. That's about as good as we can do on the history, I think, recounting it. But, and I should say before we get too far, I know I mentioned, I was more specifically talking about men's major championships. They are set to host the 2022 U.S. Mid-Am next year and also the 2025 U.S. Women's Open, which should be really awesome as well. It'd be cool to see how that scale of the game kind of fits a big place like that. And on that note, let's jump into the actual golf course. I know you mentioned the scale, the land movement. I think those are two kind of, you know, things that will jump out at you at, you know, any golf course that has those two things. But what else did you find really unique about it, or what else kind of stuck with you?
First of all, tell me what you think about this. I thought the course was so difficult.
Oh yeah.
I thought it was
especially,
so hard.
Especially in those conditions.
That didn't help. You know, our conditions, it was...
How far did you play? I mean, what tees did you guys
play? We played the Blues 7,100 yards, yeah. And it was raining. It was upper 60s.
That was the one thing where I was very thankful, and I know this is a theme throughout our videos, but with how brutal the conditions were, with how cold it was, with how much wind there was, I think my dad and I were both like, let's play it. I think we played it up at, I don't know, probably, I don't know what the different tee boxes are, but probably 63, 64,
yeah,
something like that. And from there I was like, oh wow, it's like pretty wide and fun, you don't have to hit a lot of drivers, and like,
yeah,
I had a blast. If I was playing it back where you played it, I would have shot 150, and I would completely agree with everything you're saying. I definitely get why you felt that way.
But overall, like, I thought it was really difficult because the turf and conditioning was incredible, and mm-hmm. Mike Davis back, you know, in the early 2000s was insistent on fescue fairways. If it's going to look linksy, like, let's make it linksy. Our caddy John actually told us they just transitioned over to bent fairways, and the fairways were just pure, like so firm. You know, it's that kind of pure where you can hit 50 and 60 yard pitches and you don't even like touch the ground. Like you don't even bruise the ground at all. And
yeah.
So, you know, you get out there and you're like, okay, you know, maybe the ball's going to run, which in the fairways it did. And that's a huge part of how tee shots react around there. But approach shots, it's an aerial ball game for a linksy looking course. And I think, yeah, it kind of messes with your head a little bit. I think number one, we'll get into hole one, but it's like the only approach where you could see a second shot kind of rolling up on the green. Everything else is pushed up greens, huge false fronts, the craziest bunkers you've ever seen guarding every, you know, inch in front of the green. So the hardest course I've ever played, I think, bar none.
Which is cool to hear that many people thought it was too easy for the US Open. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good to
hear. I can't wrap my head around that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure that the pro game and the amateur game will not continue to further divide. I'm sure that problem will totally take care of itself. But speaking on the US Open real quick, I mean, do you remember watching a lot of the US Open that week? And did you have any more appreciation, any more understanding of kind of what went on that week after playing it?
Yes. So one of the big things I want to talk about is tee shots. And because of the land movement, they look like ski slopes almost. You know, a lot of these fairways, you're hitting over the ski slope. And if you hit the right distance, you can get 1 yard of rollout or 100 yards, like literally. And so the only memory I have was Brooks Koepka, like, it looked like he was driving all these greens just because, you know, get it over these slopes and the ball's funneling down to a little pitch to the green. And I'm like, you get out there and that is, that's not it at all. And
yeah, that's not the typical user experience.
Yeah. And the fescue, you know, the fairways are really, really, really wide. But when you play it at the length, we all hit it kind of normal off the tee. And the bunkers are positioned to where, you know, okay, it's going to shrink the fairways automatically. And then there's so much like cant and tilt in these fairways. Like on the first hole, my partner and I both hit the middle of the fairway and ended up in the left rough. So it's like, okay, we really, you know, you have to focus on the right spot in the fairway. Furthermore, you get into the fescue and I'll go find my golf ball. No, you might not.
You know? And shout out to Kevin Na. That was one of my most memorable you know, experiences of that 2017 US Open was the Instagram video of Kevin Na dropping balls and trying to hack him out and being so just despondent about how thick the rough was. And then, of course, they went out and then cut it the next day, right? Yeah. Before the championship.
Oh, yeah. The weed whackers were out. But,
yeah,
you know, you get burned a couple times on those first holes and you're like, oh, man, I'm in the fescue. I can't, you know, it's a one and a half, two-stroke penalty being in here.
Yeah.
It makes the whole course feel more claustrophobic now. This huge fairway now feels like if I miss it, it's like it's an island fairway almost.
And, yes, that's well said. Yeah, it almost feels like playing desert golf in a way.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And, but no, it is, the strategy was all over the place. It wasn't, you know, just bash driver all day. It was if you can get to these certain runouts or these speed slots, like you're going to have a little pitch in, or you'll have 180 in if you're up on top of this hill. And it was crazy.
The shot that stuck with me the most was, and probably the most famous from that week, was the JT three wood on 18, the day he shot 63, where what did he had like 295 or 305 or something like that. And just seeing, again, I'm guessing he would tell you he probably wasn't aiming directly at that flag, but just seeing where we had the same pin and just seeing where that flag was and just what that shot looks like. Like, God, you want to talk about them like playing a different sport than what we're playing. Like it was that looked physically impossible standing there where he hit that shot from.
Two things about that marker. They have their little shamrock marker out there, which is classy. You know, it doesn't have to say
that's great.
Justin
great
Thomas hit this three wood. No, it's, you know,
exactly.
A, the amount of divots that are like to the left of it. It's pretty funny seeing all the, you know, all the buddies trips coming through trying to hit their three wood up there. Secondly, that green is, I mean,
so hard.
Arcadi's
I like five putted that green.
Yeah. If you miss short, you know, you're in a 12 foot bunker. Yeah. Oh, if that wraps all the way around to shore left behind, like if you want to bail out, sure, you can go right. And there's this huge swale you have to contend with, but.
And you're going to three putt.
You just can't miss. And from 297 or nine or whatever, like yet our caddy was telling us too. He's like, he hit three wood off the tee there. I guess the tee was moved up a little bit, I think. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, he hit three wood off the tee here because it has grooves, and he was able to, you know, like spin it a little bit. So it stops before this bunker. Who's to say?
Who's to say? What? Let's get into kind of specific holes. What were some that really stuck with you? Any you didn't like? What was your kind of, you know, review of some of the holes out there?
Yeah. So one is a great introduction. Nice handshake. You know, a medium length par five that. You get in the fairways and you feel these slopes, but then you're kind of revealed like all these micro contours in the fairways too. And yeah, you're just not going to have an even lie. And so you're kind of hit in the face with that at first.
Two was one of my favorite holes on the golf course.
Two reminds me. Yeah. Two is really fun because, you know, they're kind of asking you like, do you want to take on your blind shot on the tee shot or on the second shot? And, you know, it's this short, maybe drivable, what, 350 maybe or so?
Yeah, I think 358 from the back, 338 from the blues.
And if you can get it over this bunker, it's just going to all funnel down to like, you know, 30 and 40 yards in front of the green. But this green is like a picnic table.
Yes.
I mean, it's like seven at Sweetens where,
yeah,
you know, you're going to watch your ball like spin off the front or side or back or right. And, yeah, two was a ton of fun because you have a wedge in your hands. It feels scoreable if you can hit it, but then you can just laugh at yourself when you
as it's rolling back to your feet.
Exactly. Yeah, three through five were just brutal. I don't have a ton except for I was playing well. I was like even through two or three or four, and then like I three putted from 3 feet a couple times, and the greens were so pure, and the greens were really fast and slopey.
I remember that stretch just kind of being like where you really, you know, you walk off that second green. And I don't remember if it's the third tee or the fourth tee, but I remember one of those just kind of looking out and being like, whoa, this place is massive. This place just goes on.
Forever. Yeah, I think that's the fourth tee. You get up there and that's your first real vista of the day. You're kind of like in the far like side of the property and you're on a really high point on this tee box, which pretty much all the tee boxes, you're walking up a substantial hill from the green. But that was the first time. Yeah, you look out and you see the clubhouse and you can see the entire course in front of you. And that that really made it a pretty unique experience for me. Just, you know, that's when you get like you slide to the panorama feature on your camera on your phone and you're like hoping it captures half of what your eyes can see. And
exactly.
This is a real like beautiful moment up there on 4T before the hole punches you in the face.
Yes, exactly.
3 through 5 were like, okay, handshakes over, the meat of the course is coming and it's going to be really difficult. So
some long walks in there too, from what I remember. What else on the front nine stood out?
Yeah. So 7 and 8 really stood out. 7 is this par 5 that it wasn't quite reachable. It's 6 something, I think, but it kind of set the tone for the rest of the par 5s. 1 was pretty easy, but 7 and the rest of the par 5s felt like really hard pars at that point.
Very, very true par 5s.
You're standing on the tee and you're like, okay, let's go make a birdie. And I counted on 7. There were 16 different bunkers that you're trying to navigate. Like it's obnoxious in the
best way. If Bob was out there digging any of those, you know, there probably was only supposed to be 7 or 8. Maybe he was out there digging them.
Oh, absolutely. And it's you know, if you're trying to lay up to any number, you're contending with a bunker. And when you're hitting out of the fescue or even like the first cut of fescue, the first cut of rough, you know, you have no spin on the ball. You have no idea where it's going. And yeah, those stood out. The false fronts are bigger on the par fives. The bunkers are more menacing. And
yeah, everything's just turned up a little more.
They're not scoring opportunities. Yeah, they're more survivor tests for sure.
8's another par 4. Kind of, it's a little, I don't know if it's in the same place, but it's almost like an inverse from what I remember of, is it maybe 12 on the back nine? I got to remember what specific holes are, but just these great holes where they kind of wind around these dunes and or I don't even know if you call them dunes or hills or what you would call them, but it does such a cool job of kind of, you know, some holes you're going over them, sometimes some holes you're going around them, some holes you're going between them. And that was a great one of just kind of, you know, basically putting a massive hill between you and the tee, figuring out how much you want to try to go over it, how much you want to try to go around it. That was just a really cool challenge. I think it was number 12 was was similar in the same way. Might have even been the same hill. They might run right next to each other.
And that's, you know, we didn't even talk about the land and, you know, supposedly why it's as absurd as it is, formed by glaciers that melted.
Shout out to glaciers.
Yeah. Right. But no, 8 was, I remember on 3 or 4, like looking over and you see this hill, you're like, what hole is that? Like, when do I get to go play that hole? And it's the first, like this kind of ski slope where if I hit it over it and you know, your drive is like 80% of the battle on that hole. You know, if you, it's a dogleg left in the whole fairway and everything is running to the right and you're going like, you're aiming over this like 14-year-old 4-caddy kid that's sitting up there that gives you like the flag if you did good. And really, really interesting hole. 9 might be one of my favorite holes.
Definitely the best, probably the best photo on the course, right?
Yeah.
Straight downhill par 3 to just, you know, you got a little water in the background. You got just, it's a very scenic shot.
And the other par 3 is like 237 yards. So having a,
right.
having like a 9-iron in your hand feels good for once is like,
yes, exactly.
Know, play between like 130 and 150, I guess. But
also the green is completely turned up and really small sections to try to hit. Not easy by any stretch.
It's a Andy Johnson potato chip green.
It very much is. Yeah, exactly. That's really what it feels like.
It feels like 9 at Chambers, kind of severely downhill. And if you miss, like our caddy was telling us, Zach Johnson got in, like, go look up a picture of the fingers in these bunkers. Like,
yes.
You could, if you hit in the bunker, like a good percentage, you might not get out after a couple shots. And I think Zach Johnson made like an 8. He got stuck in one of these like little crevices in one of these bunkers. And just, you could play ping pong for a long time going over that green from bunker to bunker. And yeah, 9 was a blast.
10 feels like you're on that hole for 45 minutes was kind of how I felt, just straight back up the hill, just forever. That was a kind of kick in the teeth. I remember that one pretty vividly. 11, 12, anything to add on those?
10, it's nice when you get up to your ball and your caddy's like, cool, you have 250 yards in for your second shot.
Yes.
That was nice.
Exactly.
thanks a lot, buddy. And then
But there, wasn't there a kind of like a speed slot on that one too, that like ultra long players could get down on the, I'm trying to remember, maybe I'm misremembering that, but I thought there was a slot you could really like shoot down the hill on the right side or something like that.
Oh, on 11?
On 10, sorry.
Oh, on 10. Yeah, on.
Yeah.
The only thing about 10, I remember our caddy was telling us it is like, you know, at one point the fairway is like honestly 100 yards wide. And, I mean, yeah, it's really wide, but that whole, any aspiration of like, cool, I just shot, you know, X on the front nine, let's go get it on the back nine is just, you know, put out right there on 10. 11 yep. is really, really fun. A shortish, could be drivable par four coming down the hill again. But that gets me, 12 is my favorite hole.
Yeah. That one was really stuck with me as well.
I took so many pictures of 12. Just, you're right. Similar to 8, where you're going over this massive, you know, glacial dune sort of ski slope. And, but the green is like carved down between these two little dunes. And
it just, it sits in like such a cool place. It's such a cool vision to put the green there. And yeah, I'm with you. I couldn't really put my finger on it, but you just kind of come around that corner, you see it, you're like, God, that is really a handsome green. That looks awesome.
I mean, it looks as natural as a hole could be. Like, yeah, we're going to go over this and we're going to perch down into this little green. But I love holes where you look, you're on the green and you look back and you're just in like,
yeah,
amazement on like, how did I walk that and get like a golf ball, you know, manage that too. So
I feel very bad. Our caddy got hit by a golf ball on that hole.
Oh my gosh. Tough.
Because as you know, it's kind of a blind tee shot. And I guess the caddy behind, you know, had the boys firing when they should not have been firing. It was crazy. I looked back. I mean, he just took it like, I couldn't say it fast enough, but I could see it all happening in slow motion. Just ball comes in slowly, right to the shoulder blade. It was very tough. Very tough.
12 was so much fun. And it was one of those where, the guy I was playing against had like 90 yards in and I had 180 yards in and I didn't even care. Like the view you have and the tiny target you're trying to, you know, toss your ball into is, it was a really fun challenge. Like I mean, that's what Irish golf is, right? Like,
yeah, totally. Exactly. That's the best example of that. I think, the next one that kind of stuck with me, I don't know about you, was 15 is probably the, you know, the one that got a lot of run during the US Open, but just short four, they could move the tees all over the place. I think they, you know, you could kind of make it play as short as like 299 if they moved it all the way up, but it plays about 370 from the back. That's where the Kevin Na video was, which was a little unfair because he was about, you know, 70 yards left of center when he was doing that. But yeah, just a really awesome hole, like the most menacing bunkers you've ever seen on that right side of the green. Just nightmare shit on there. But also just, I love, there's just so many cool slopes. 15 is a great example, but just so many cool slopes of that can help your ball, right? Like we talk about this a fair amount where, you know, when you go to Pinehurst number two, a lot of the slopes are there to hurt your ball.
Yeah.
Right. And to push you away from the hole. When you go down the road to Tobacco Road, a lot of the slopes are there to help you. Right. And there's of course two sides to all of those slopes and they can bite you as well. But there are a lot of spots where at Erin Hills where, you know, if you want to play that kind of game, like you don't have to aim at the hole. You can, you know, you can use slopes to your benefit. And 15 was a really fun example of that, where especially if you get that pin kind of front left there, there's that little almost like mini punch bowl inside of that green, which was really fun.
You know, I saw that and I wanted to play that big punch bowl, but I laid up. And when you lay up on 15, you're laying up to like 140 yes. and you're taking all the trouble out.
Patrick Cantlay at the USAM, I think, hit 8-iron off the tee and laid up into a bunker and lost the match. Crazy.
Yeah. I think at the USAM, they moved it like way up to like 240 or
way
something.
Up. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
From the Reds. And yeah, so you're laying up and the target is pretty small. It's uphill. You know, you can't quite see the front of the green, but you have this punch bowly on the back. And I think I just went too far. And this is like my one or two points of negative contention with the course is, you can see the ball bounce in the fescue and know where it is and not find your golf ball. And that happened to me a couple times, like right behind 15 green.
I think some of that, we
kind of frustrating.
You know, I know it's a little, we talked about it a little bit with Royal St. George's, even with the Open recently, but I think by all accounts, everything I've heard from supers and greenskeepers and stuff is just how hard it is to maintain like that type of native area in any kind of way that makes it both playable, but not too wispy, but not too dense. Like, to find that happy medium is apparently, you know, one of the toughest things that they could possibly do. And so I know it's been a crazy wet year up there. So I wonder if it's almost similar to what we saw at the Open, where it's like, dude, it's just, there's not much we can do. It's pretty out of control right now.
You know, I thought of one other similarity to Royal St. George's was the tee boxes. You know, imagine just like a field of fescue 4 feet tall.
Yeah.
And then like a 15 by 15 foot, just purely manicured little tee box. And so every hole pretty much has that. And every hole has some sort of forced carry, whether it's 100 yards or 150 or 200 yard forced carry, just to get to like where I'm going to go find my golf ball. I could see that being pretty difficult to bring a higher handicapper out. And
totally. No, I mean, it was built for championship golf, right? I mean, it feels like it when you're out there, and I think that's a thrill every now and again, right? I don't think by any means, you know, Erin Hills is somewhere I'd want to go play every single day, because I think you would just get blunt force trauma from doing that. But it is fun to, you know, I don't know. We say this about all kinds of different places, but it's fun to see how different the professional game is.
And absolutely. Yeah.
It was built for that. It was not built for resort guests. And so I could see, you know, there's going to be some pretty upset resort guests who have a pretty bad time out there. But if you, you know, I would say, I mean, the way I would kind of put it, you know, you hate to be like, I don't know, you hate to be elitist in this way or whatever, but like, I would be able to golf your ball probably if you're going up to Erin Hills. I think if you want to have a good time, you need to, you know, be able to get it airborne consistently is a pretty good prerequisite, right?
Yeah, I would say so. Also, like the ocean course kind of, it reminded me of that a little bit, where your view, like there's no trees, there's nothing kind of like guiding you except for the fairway and all these bunkers. And yeah, it feels like, you know, the tee shots can kind of feel pretty menacing, as far as like, I'm teeing up and hitting into this like open space somewhere, and I hope I go find my golf ball after this. And 15 was a blast. 16, I thought, just one quick note on 16, is fun to have a blind par three in the United States.
Yes.
That was really cool. Definitely. Couldn't see the pin. 17, no bunkers on that hole. Dead straight, kind of boring. And then 18 is, I mean, one of the toughest finishing holes, I thought, that I've ever played. Watching
very,
these guys,
very true par five. Yeah,
watching these guys go flip a three wood up and eagle it real quick was, you know, I had that impression going in, like, let's go birdie the finishing hole. And no, that did not happen.
Hanging on for dear life. Well, before we wrap up here, what was kind of your lasting impression? What's your kind of lasting recommendation to people? I know when I was there, weirdly, I know I keep talking about how hard it was, and you keep saying the same thing, but I really wanted to go play it again immediately, just because I thought there was so much interest in so many of the holes. I thought there were so many different ways you could play holes. And maybe a lot of that, like I said, was just playing an up tee and kind of keeping the ball in play and not feeling like I was hanging on for dear life the whole day. But I just had such a blast. I was like, man, I wish I was staying longer, because that's the kind of weird part about it, right? Is it's not in the middle of nowhere, but it's not, you know, it's not a destination necessarily with a bunch of critical mass where there's, you know, a bunch of restaurants and all kinds of things to do. So I think a lot of people are pretty one done, right? I mean, they come in and then they go off to wherever else they're going. And it was really, like, that was kind of my biggest takeaway, was like, man, I want to go play that place again. And counterintuitively, I do feel like it would be a fun place to go play two or three times in the same trip, rather than going to a place where you're playing two or three different golf courses. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that.
No, I totally agree. And, you know, the other thing they do is their little five hole whiskey loop. They call it the kettle loop. Mm-hmm. And it kind of gets to the heart of that, as like, they take completely different tee boxes, and, you know, some cases they're making different holes out there, And it sort of feels like that, where you could go out and completely play a different course every time and really go.
Right.
Like some of those green complexes, I would love to spend 30 minutes, you know, just hitting different shots. There's so many fun different shots you could try that, you know, when you go through it once, you don't quite get that opportunity. So, yeah, we saw a ton of buddies trips out there. Could be a fun, like, 2-3 day sort of thing.
And they got the nice, the lighted putting course in the evening. And it does feel like it's a cool spot. I mean, it feels pretty, you feel pretty off the grid while you're there, but also there's, you know, great lodging on site and great restaurants on site and all that kind of stuff. So it's a cool, it's pretty unique in that it doesn't have the massive critical mass of, you know, Sand Valley or something, even Whistling Straits, you know, kind of those two in opposite directions, but it has enough. It's got it's a pretty compelling idea to go spend 2 or 3 days there. I think
my two closing thoughts: one, it does feel like you're completely removed from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
It's a really cool, especially when you're up on top of, like, 15 had my favorite, you know, one of these vistas where 15 is kind of perched in the middle of the property and you just look out and all Bob Lang was buying up property, so you don't see the homes that he leveled, but you don't see another home. Like, you don't see anything else except for this incredible golf course. And so you feel like alone with the course, and it's all walking. This, you know, they don't even allow push carts. So there's so little distractions. You know, everyone's just walking and playing golf. My other lasting final thought was it's 100% public golf course. There's no members. And Arcadio was telling us that what he loves about that is that he gets to treat every person the same. Like, you come, you know, we're all kind of here because we love golf and, you know, we made the trip out here, heard about it. And you really feel welcomed in a way that a lot of other, you know, private or got an invite or higher end courses, or even like sometimes resort courses where it was a really authentic, like, welcoming vibe from everybody. And that was a really cool thing to experience, for sure.
That's so well said. And I think that's kind of what I was trying to scratch at there, was it doesn't have the critical mass of a resort, but it also doesn't have, like, the downsides of feeling like a resort. And of course, you know, Sand Valley and all those places are great. They're awesome to go spend time at, but yeah, you do feel a little more anonymous, right? When you're there, and there's only a fixed number of people kind of at Erin Hills at once, and it feels like it. So I think you hit the nail on the head there. That's really well said. What do you think? Does that do it for Erin Hills? Anything else you got? Did you empty the chamber?
I think so. Their practice facility was incredible. Did you see their short game area?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Did you see the caddy barn?
The caddy barn is sick. Fun fact, they have printed out, I only know this, you can ask me why, but in the caddy restroom, they have all of the articles printed out, the newspaper framed. Thought that was pretty cool.
That's cool.
Their story has, like, they're not ashamed of anything or not embarrassed about anything. Like, it was really cool to, like, you know, they were talking about it. The caddy was giving us more information, and that was cool to see their story, like, you know, something they're, you know, proud is a weird word with what happened. And
no, but totally,
they got the US Open. They got this relationship with the USGA. So
exactly. I think that's kind of where we started. I think that can be where we ended is what an unlikely, God, what an unlikely success story, right? Like that, the fact that, you know, no matter what happened, I mean, a lot of bad stuff kind of happened along the way to make it happen, but it literally happened. It's crazy. I don't know if they'll ever get another men's major. I don't know how that'll go, but I really hope they do. I mean, I loved watching that week at Erin Hills. I know it kind of turned into a bit of a snooze, just, you know, with no wind blowing. And I think it would have been a completely different place had that wind blown, for all the reasons that we just spent 45 minutes talking about, all the bunkers and the rough and the runoffs and the different sections of greens and the slopes and all those things would have been infinitely more of a factor if the wind was blowing, and it wasn't. And also Brooks was, you know, kind of playing the best golf of his life. So that made it a little bit of a snooze too, competitively anyways. And yeah, I don't know if they'll ever get another one, but I really hope they do. In the meantime, can't wait for the US Women's Open there. I think that'll be really fun to see how that goes. And I can't wait to get back up there. Matt, thank you for Thanks for talking about it.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Yeah, it was a blast. It was really cool to see it in person and, you know, watch on TV, read about it, and then go experience it for yourself. And yeah, can't wait to get back.
Sounds good. Well, we need to get you back in the edit bay. So much content to crank out, but thank you for taking your morning to knock this out.
Absolutely. Cheers.
See ya.